Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host for today's episode, where we will be speaking with Dr. Noelle McAfee on her book, Fear of Breakdown, Politics and Psychoanalysis, Columbia University Press, 2019. Dr. McAfee is a professor of philosophy, as well as the director of the Psychoanalytic Studies Program at Emory University. Her books include Habermas, Kristeva, and Citizenship, Julia Kristeva, and Democracy and the Political Unconscious, three separate books. We welcome her to our show and look forward to discussing her very exciting and thought-provoking ideas that pertain to our moment in ways that this promises to be a generative interview. That's all the best I can say. So welcome to our show. So our first question is for all of the authors that we speak to is we like to ask about motivation. So would you like to tell us a little bit about what you know about, to the degree you can know about your motivations, what motivated the writing of this book?
Oh, thank you. First, Tracy, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a super big honor, and I'm delighted and looking forward to this. motivation for the book. It's like, how far back in my own history do you want to go? I won't go all that.
We accept all answers.
You know, I guess something in me is always looking for justice and really troubled by the lack of it. For years, I've thought that about my work is at the intersection of subjectivity and public life, literally right there at that intersection. So where the kinds of people we are, what kind of politics allows us to show up in the world and shape the world. And then conversely, what kind of phenomena keep us from having a place and a say in the world, whether it's other people and other forces and power and all that, or it's our own troubles. So that's been my interest for years. I started off back in my 20s working in Washington, D.C. I'd gotten a master's in public policy and was interested in fighting the good fight. And then I worried that no amount of fighting the good fight would work if people weren't really interested in or capable of self-government. So I thought, I have to figure this out. And I went back to, for some reason, I thought philosophy would help. And on the way there, I'd gotten interested in Julia Kristeva as a kind of French, quote unquote, French feminist thinker. And that kind of pulled me into the world of psychoanalysis, too, thinking about, again, the forces that help create our subjectivity. So that was, for many years, my work was on democracy and how it was possible that we could be strangers to ourselves and still work collectively with others to shape the world. Right? You know, the problem of false consciousness. I mean, how that seems like so often people do things that are contrary to their self-interest, that we are strangers to ourselves, don't know ourselves. So that was my question. And I was very much an optimist. That took a bit of a turn after 9/11, especially when people in power were saying things like, we do not talk with the enemy. And I thought, well, shouldn't we talk? Really? So that was the motivation for Democracy and the Political Unconscious, my previous book, was really about the kind of talking cure that could be had through a more deliberative democratic politics. This book, so I was going to spell that out more. That was when I started writing this several years ago. I was going to spell out what that looks like more. And along the way, I got interested in more interest in psychoanalysis and started taking courses at our institute here at Emory University Psychoanalytic Institute, along with other candidates to become analysts. And along the way, read Winnicott. So this is a rather long answer to your question, but read some Winnicott, and it was a few years ago, and read that essay that I know you know on fear of breakdown. And he was talking about, you know, sometimes we have to explain to our more psychotic patients that this fear they have, doctor, I'm going to fall apart, doctor, I'm going to die, doctor, I feel so empty, doctor, I'm going to have a breakdown. That this fear they have of something terrible to happen is actually an agony over something that already happened, but they were too incapable at the time to take it in. So the point of analysis with these patients is to help them take in the breakdown that already happened and put it into the past. So in the background, right? I can't remember what year that was, but that was right about the time that, Donald Trump was running for president. And so reading that, and along in that essay, it's a very cryptic essay of his, he talks about these agonies that get triggered, these primitive or like is it primordial, archaic agonies. And one is this fear of falling apart triggers a defense of self-holding, to hold oneself together. So I thought about that. And this fear of this need for self-holding reminded me of, the great political slogan of our time, to make America great again, that Donald Trump's, we're going to make America great again because we're going to otherwise fall apart. They're going to destroy us, is exactly like a fear of breakdown. It's a fantasy that something terrible in the future is going to happen. So there's a need to cling to some great moment in the past, which is a complete delusion. We were never great. And so there's a kind of, we can talk about this more, but this strange looping of time to regress to a fantasy of some perfect time in the past to ward off a breakdown of the future. So reading that, it just clicked that so many of these phenomena could be read, that we can talk about today, can be read through that lens.
Well, thank you for that, Vera. The second question I was going to ask you was, let's lay out the bare bones of fear breakdown, but I think that you've just done that for us. So just to alert the listeners, you've now, if you don't know the work of Winnicott and you don't know this essay, I think it's just been given a good description. I wanted to ask you also, can you define for the listeners how you're using the word politics?
Well, that's good. Well, I do not mean the standard definition. If you look it up some places, you'll get what was Max Weber's definition, which was politics is the monopoly on forces, coercive forces, or that's what politics is, those who have that power. And that makes me, my skin crawl, that answer. I'd see politics more along the lines of the practice of deciding what to do when we do not agree with each other and there is no right or agreed upon answer. So in the face of uncertainty and the need to act, to do something, we engage in politics, right? So I borrow that from Benjamin Barber, who lays that out in Strong Democracy. Yeah, so it that's what democracy is. Now, there are different forms of democracy. Whoever gets to take part in the task of deciding what ought to be done is a citizen. They have the power of citizenship. In a monarchy, there's one citizen, that's the king. In a democracy, everyone is supposed to have that power. So I see democracy as this broad, public, potentially widespread practice of all who are affected by matters of common concern being able to help shape those. So that would be a democratic politics. There's lots of different forms, but it also is about that, trying to decide what to do or what to, you know, what to, not just to problem solve, but to what to create, what to do next when we don't agree. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I have had so many thoughts about what it means to participate, how to participate. I guess I'm going to ask you kind of a question from the point of view, like thinking myself as a clinician. You have, what do you say? Democratic politics, you write, calls for growing up, moving beyond black and white thinking, learning to live with uncertainty and ambivalence. It's sort of a paraphrase, I think, but more or less that I think is an idea that you sort of need throughout the book, K-N-E-A-D throughout the book. But I wondered if I myself am ready for such political practice because of the difficulty of actually growing up, moving beyond black and white thinking, learning to live with uncertainty and ambivalence. And I'm wondering, like, I asked myself, well, so how does, let's say, the melancholic take part? Like, who can participate in this by deliberation? What's being argued here is it's more of a face to face, right? We're gonna listen to each other. We're gonna hear each other. We're gonna hear things we don't like to hear. We're gonna have ideas put toward us that are gonna arouse very difficult feelings, sometimes anger, sometimes a desire to annihilate because the idea coming toward us feels so threatening. Like, who gets to participate?
Yeah, let me hold off on that question because there's a something missing between what I just said about what politics is and what you quoted. So the missing part is that, okay, so let's say here we have a practice, we have to decide what to do when we don't agree with each other. Now, let's say the melancholic, and we can explain that more. The person who's not grown up is going to say, damn it, we're going to do what I want. And what you want is reprehensible, unacceptable, and no, no, no. So that from that kind of position, the person who's engaging in politics isn't actually interested in engaging or dealing with the uncertainty and disagreement. They just want to stamp their feet and have their own way, right? So to really engage in politics and trying to solve problems with others, and Hannah Arendt is a real deep resource for me, and plurality, when different points of view, different aspirations, different ways of seeing the world. If we're really seriously going to engage in plurality and difference with others, we need to be willing to take up and consider their other points of view. That's why it means growing up, because the person who's going to cling to their own ideal or their fantasy or whatever, and they might be right, but they're only willing to deal with their own. They're not ready to engage in this difference. So what, tell me again your question that.
I was just thinking about who's in the room. And here's another thing. What your book really raises is that we've lost, under the reign of of neoliberalism, we've lost associations, associative space, places where people are coming together to hash out, you know, what to do, how do we deal with the resources that, you know, we have that we need for this or for that, how that space in and of itself has shrunk. So I love what you're talking about. I love the idea of deliberating together. And yet I'm like, when's the last time I participated? And I was very involved with ACT UP in the late 1980s, which was a group run by Robert's Rules of Orders, 700 people in a room here in New York City every Monday night, like deliberating. But even that space has disappeared. So there was something very, that aroused some longing in me when I was reading the book. I was like, where do we even deliberate together anymore?
I bet you've been involved in deliberation in your institute when you're trying to decide what to do on some question, or even with your family or with your friends when you're trying to decide what to do. I mean, these are all, so deliberation isn't just solely a political activity. It's what we do all the time. You know, is anybody going to actually go into a store or go to a barbershop? That calls for a lot of deliberation. Right? What are the consequences? What will happen? What are we willing to do? Deliberation is having to tarry with different possible choices, each with their consequences, losses, right? I mean, if I go in one direction, I really need to be willing to deal with all the loss of what I give up by not going another direction, or what I'm going to lose by going here rather than there. So I see deliberation as really an affective process of dealing with the consequences of any course of action. So if we're doing that mentally, right, we're deliberating. Georgia, I live in Georgia. Our governor has opened up the state. I can go get a tattoo this afternoon. I have not tempted the least bit, but you know, anything that I might do is calling for an act of deliberation about having to make a difficult choice. And that happens in our organizations. And so I don't make a, because I, you know, call politics as a very widespread thing whenever we're trying to address matters of common concern, there's not a sharp line between what's political or social or personal. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And something, I think another important point made by the book is the role of feelings in politics. There's somewhere you say something like, you know, political philosophy has the idea that thinking has to do with the reasoning. And you say, well, actually, since we're strangers to ourselves and at some level driven by motivations and by feelings we understand in the afterwards, you are arguing for, I guess, that we should all expect to have difficult feelings when we take part in deliberative and in deliberations, that it's that we shouldn't expect to be, it shouldn't necessarily be, we shouldn't expect to feel great, but there's an expectable amount of discomfort. And yet we do live in a moment where, you know, in a culture that says, you know, you can choose how you feel. You know, that's a neoliberal slogan, if I've ever heard one. And patients come in terrorized by that idea. Well, I'm going to choose how I feel about this. And I was like, well, when's the last time that, you know, feelings were ever listened to a choice? So listen to, you know, sort of my conscious mind, don't feel this. And so I was thinking about, it's kind of a tough, your argument is, how do we put forth and begin to insist upon the role of feelings in decision-making in the political realm? Any thoughts?
Yeah, so the background, there is part of my work, my area is called a deliberative democracy. And in philosophy and in political theory, political science, the people who do that are often talking about reason as if it's were some separate separate faculty devoid of feeling. Sorry, I had a sip of water. And I just don't go there at all. I mean, for one thing, reason, you know, comes from the Greek logos, word. And back in Homer's time, the roots of that was basically someone speaking to themselves. Menelaos ipe, he spoke to himself. So thinking was taking the social activity of back and forth dialogue with someone else and internalizing it and have a back and forth with oneself. That's all that logos is. It's not like a logic exam, right? It's talking back and forth. Well, I could maybe go do this, but then I think, but what about that? So I'm entertaining different possibilities and responding to them. So if somebody gives me a reason, they say, well, we should do this because of XYZ. That's going to elicit feelings in me, maybe of excitement or fear. So I'm entertaining the reasons, and they bring up feelings. These are not separate things. So where so much of political theory thinks about deliberative democracy, it's about reason. I'm bringing in there's always affect, and in fact, real deliberation. This seems so obvious to me, but I might be kind of alone. Real deliberation.
No, I'm with you.
Okay. Real deliberation. As I said, means dealing with loss. So there's a phrase in political theory, public will formation, some fancy term for when people have deliberated, reasoned through something, and developed a public will that we should do this and not that. Mm-hmm. But what is will, public will? And any analyst knows that it's what one has come to having worked through all the feelings and anxieties, whatever, ghosts, worked through them and come out the other side, right? So deliberation will lead to a public will when people have become willing to pay for something, really, in whatever sense.
Mm-hmm. What about thinking about Winnicott and your use of Winnicott? I don't know if you refer, you might, and I might have just missed it, also his essay, The Use of an Object. And I was thinking about whether to enter into deliberative democratic practices, one has to be ready to survive destruction, being destroyed. I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Wow, that's really interesting. I haven't thought about that. We can think about it right now.
Okay.
So I think of the Winnicott essays from the point of view of the one who's going to use the object, mm-hmm. And knowing that if the object is destroyed, the object will carry on, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's to find out.
Do you want me to tell you? I mean, I was thinking about the ways in which, in order to get to the place where, the idea is that the baby destroys and destroys the needed object survives destruction, then the baby can then begin to maybe deliberate a little bit, like that deliberation. We don't just get to the place where we can be able to, stand looking at difference. It's very, can be very challenging, right? I mean, my patients, don't want to enter into group analysis, which I run groups and I do group and individual. It's part of the modern psychoanalytic sort of mode in me. But many patients don't want to, let's say be in a group because the experience of difference, sharing, and loss all come to the fore. They have to share me. They have to lose the fantasy that I am just there for them, et cetera. So I'm just thinking about when things break down, as they can break down when people are trying to make decisions about, imperfect situations, that to get to a place where we can hear each other, often we have to see that the other can tolerate our worst. And then we have someone who we can actually talk to and see as somebody who is like us. Like, I'm a little skeptical about how, given narcissistic vulnerability and fragility, how do we get people to work together? I think that it's extraordinarily challenging, and it's beautiful and amazing when it happens. But I don't know. So the use of an object came to mind. I don't know if that.
Yeah, I think what comes to my mind is that, as I was saying before, somebody who's not really willing to engage in difference and consider other points of view and is clinging to their own ideal, right? And cannot tolerate entertaining other ideals is, I believe, worried that if they consider other points of view, that their own ideals will be destroyed. So the need to kind of protect them and ward away any alternatives is the fear that one's own ideals cannot survive that kind of plurality of points of view. So it is, and that's why I find it problematic kind of politics of demands. This group has listed their demands and the rest of us are supposed to go along. Maybe their demands are perfectly good, right? I mean, they can be, in my university, there was a group that had demands and the faculty took them up and just said, how are we going to meet these demands? And I want to say, well, can we talk about these? I mean, why are these just black and white demands rather than options for us to consider together? Maybe we can get to another place that's even better or some alternative rather than that. So I don't know if it's exactly, it's kind of like the use of an object, but I think that the worry is whether one's own political ideals will survive.
Right. Whether will I survive? Will my ideals survive? I need my ideals to help me survive the fact that I'm, you know, I'm so lacking anyway. So, taking away any of those ideals, can pose a very, a terrible threat. I wanted to ask you something. Recently I had a back and forth with a friend, and I mean really recently, like a month ago. So, you know, as time has collapsed and gotten very strange during the pandemic, here in New York City, every night at 7 p.m., we open our windows and we clap for the essential workers. And about a month ago, we didn't have a sufficient cache of ventilators here in the city, and it was pretty terrifying. And it was clear who's going to die, who was going to be not given a ventilator. Like, all of those questions were upon us. And I was wondering why, in a moment where lives are hanging in the balance, are we not using words? Why are we just clapping? And why aren't we also, I said, yelling out our windows, send us the ventilators? Like, what if the whole city erupted into like a chant like that? And I was talking to a friend who's a very Kleinian friend, actually. She said, well, people are grieving and they're showing gratitude and it's not a time to make, as she said, demands. And I said, well, where's the anger that people feel about being treated so poorly? I mean, the government seems and has seemed hell bent on extinguishing life, right? So was the gratitude a defense? Were we complicit? Were we cowed? I know that, you know, in what you're talking about, and you have a critique of those who make demands. But I said to her, well, you know, sometimes the paranoid schizoid position is not exactly the worst thing for politics. She was like, what, are you crazy? Anyway, from that point of view, I mean, you know, when I was with ACT UP, we made demands. We weren't negotiating. Of course, we were from the point of view of like the differends, the Lyotardian differends. So, you know, and then ACT UP was followed by Occupy Wall Street, which didn't like demands. I like demands. They, of course, imply negotiation afterwards, but at least you put out the limit of like, this is really what we'd like to see happen.
Yeah, there's different moments in politics. So in the heart of the book are these what I call six democratic practices. And some of them look like demands. I think the movements for protesting, mass demonstrations are moves to put things on the agenda. I call it my third one, identifying and thematizing problems, consciousness raising, setting the agenda. And that often is on the part of activist social movements to demand that we need to take up climate change or demand that we have more PPE, right? Whatever, personal protective equipment, whatever it is that we need to put that on the agenda. But as you just said, of course, later then we'll negotiate. And so after we put something on the agenda or in the process, then there's the other step, which is to deliberate and take up different ways of, you know, trying to achieve figure out what we want and how are we going to get it? How are we going to do that? So there are different moments. Yeah. I want to go back to something about the kind of entertaining different points of view. So yeah, I started off by invoking the fear of breakdown in Donald Trump. This happens on all sides, right? It happens on all sides. And it's so difficult to even acknowledge what is behind an alternative point of view, because I find this, if I'm going to try to acknowledge what is important and understandable about somebody who I completely disagree with politically, yeah, let's just say, some conservative Christian evangelical who thinks that, you know, we got to open up the economy, but whatever it is, if I'm going to entertain and engage in politics with some others, I need to try to understand what's legitimate about their point of view. And it's hard to do that. I mean, it's hard to do that because you think people are going to think I've lost my mind, but it's hard to say, well, I can see that some people are motivated truly by loyalty or faith. And that's not, so it's hard work to try to truly engage with others with whom we disagree. That's what I wanted to say about that.
Yes. Well, absolutely. Because it's, we don't, you know, life with like a mirror held up before us, is simple, but it's not actually engaging, with difference. Yeah, it's funny. As you were talking, I was thinking of my cousin who lives in Atlanta, and he is an evangelical Christian. He is my closest family member. We are as close could be, but we agree down the line about many, many things politically, but abortion. And on occasion, I make sure that we talk, and I ask questions. I try to listen, and he tries to listen. And I have to say, actually, you know, that we never come to the same place, but there is something about our relationship that has a durability to it because we encounter each other's different points of view, and we listen, we hear. Neither of us has changed our position, but I would say our relationship has an incredible intimacy precisely because we don't shy away from the thing that, or an issue that is, that we have such strong feelings about, that we actually take the time, not, you know, every time we talk, but probably like three times a year. I think I initiate it more than he does, but anyway, but I want us to talk, to not just skirt the issue. And it creates an intimacy, that with friends who we agree, it's not, there's a different kind of intimacy that comes from it. So that's the upside. I mean, the motivation.
Yeah. And also, so in addition to just thinking about this stuff academically or psychoanalytically, over the years, I've been involved in actual deliberative forums with people in the public for many, many years. And what I've noticed, and others have noticed, is that when people from different backgrounds, beliefs, et cetera, get together and deliberate, they walk away saying, you know, I didn't really change my view, but I sure changed my view of her view and her. So there was one deliberative forum where we had, it was back in the 90s, the quintessential, you know, rich lady from New York, Republican from New York in her fur coat, and the welfare mother, quote unquote, from the projects in Chicago. And they were talking about family values and health care and stuff like that. And they didn't agree at the end, but they both said, wow, she actually loves her children. As if that was just, this person's human. I mean, they have, that's what happens in a polarized politics. People can demonize each other. And that's what we've got. I mean, that was one of the big motivations for this book, was the kind of rampant demonization and turning others into stick figures, cartoon characters, inhuman. And there's no way that we can move ahead if we are stuck in that.
Right, right. And it's also the relief that is felt, I think it's worth emphasizing, you know, to think about, like, when you move beyond that demonization, you realize how much of your own psychic energy was invested in that demonization, how little psychic energy you had to use for other purposes. I mean, and I can feel like, and it's almost like the pleasure of having your paranoid schizoid moment is the relief you have when you let go of it and you take in the difference, you know, the demonization disappears. It's like I don't know, but I see it, you know, in myself, I see it in my patients, I see it in my friends. Like, it's like always like, wow, it was almost worth having the paranoid schizoid thought just to experience to get rid of it. And, you know, put both feet back on the ground, you know.
Yeah. And you're using the Kleinian terms. And so, you know, I want to just point out that for people listening, that I'm very emotive, I mean, very informed by Klein, what she calls these primitive, I'm trying not to use the word primitive, archaic, primordial defenses are what happens to groups too, right? So any political group can start to do this with other groups. We regress to these archaic positions and demonize the other. It's that very phenomenon she was talking about small children, we can see in whole groups.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask you a question. I've been wanting to ask somebody this question, and I think your book really brings, you make use of mourning. And I've been thinking a lot about the concept of mourning maybe has reached a saturation point in applied psychoanalysis, according to me. Okay, not according to anybody else, but according to me. You know, from Judith Butler onward, you know, whenever that essay, Gender Melancholy, you know, how old is that essay? Like 1999 or something. But I'm wondering about, you know, our use of mourning as a kind of theoretical panacea. And I don't know if you have you know, you use mourning. I like how you use mourning. I'm not against mourning, you know, I think mourning, first of all, cannot be commanded, demanded, or people can't be brought to it. It's a process, and one can develop the capacity to mourn. I've met many people who have never, that capacity is not coming to full fruition in them anytime soon. But I wonder about this. In our clinging to mourning, or in our use of mourning, are we not leaving the more thorny domain of human aggression and destructiveness unattended to? Like, you know, violence is a refusal to mourn. Okay, I get that. But if we play down the role of the drives, are we at risk of minimizing a crucial aspect of what it means to be human? You know, like, because mourning is easy for people to deal with. Like, oh, it's nice, it's civilized, etc. But we're also, I definitely am a drive theorist. I'm like, we take pleasure in destructive acts.
Well, I don't know where do we get this idea that mourning is nice and civilized? I mean, if somebody's in grief, they're raging, they're angry. When I've lost people who are important to me, I am not just nice and civilized. I'm a mess, and I'm grieving and I'm raging. And that it's a process. It's difficult. By the time we finally come out, you know, and can reconnect with the world and all, it might look more nice and civilized. But it's through a process that can look a lot like rage and aggression. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But there's just something about it that I'm thinking, like, you know, the failure to mourn. I see more the failure to mourn than the capacity to mourn. Maybe it's just because that's my job. I sit in my office and I see, you know, the failure to mourn. Maybe that's who, you know, ends up on the couch, right? Failures in mourning. But it just seems to me like a little bit too easy an answer, like that we're turning, you know, it's McIvor and, you know, Mari Rudy. I mean, people are writing about mourning. I don't know. Just as a clinician, I keep thinking, what about human destructiveness, and what do we do with human destructiveness? Because that seems to me as much a problem as the failure to mourn. And I wouldn't say that human destructiveness is only the failure to mourn. But anyway, in all the splitting that we have, we can say, oh, well, there's a failure to mourn. But there's also just a pleasure in destructiveness. You know, how does that fit into our thinking about this current world? So I'm not expecting you to have the answer, and maybe
I think we might have different views about aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I listened to your interview with Ben Fong, which I found very interesting, and I love his book. I blurbed his book, mm-hmm. And what, you know, partly what I take from that and from reading Freud is that you know, so a lot of times this all, the theory of aggression begins with the death drive. And then beyond the pleasure principle, it's trying to understand how people can engage in things that are so painful over and over and over again. And likening it to kind of falling back into the primordial ooze and losing oneself. And then somewhere Freud turns it around. And so it, you know, the death drive turned outward is aggression, and that now must be this innate thing. I don't follow that move, that aggression is some innate practice.
You view it as based on frustration or?
Yeah, I think it's a misfire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it happens. I mean, when we, through loss, we can feel a lot of rage.
For sure.
Which is, again, kind of a primitive, or sorry, there I go again, primordial clinging to something that was lost, not wanting to let go of it.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of aggression as driven by frustration, it's very different than just human beings are, you know, man is wolf to man kind of thing. I mean, those two, like, there's not, yeah, that it's hard because they're just very, very, very different arguments. Actually, let me ask you something. I loved where, hold on one second. I want to just grab it here. You had something to say. Here we go. About the relational view. And when we first spoke, Noelle and I spoke a week ago, just in preparation for the interview, and you said, oh, are you relational? And I was like, no. But you write about relational psychoanalysis, and you're a real fan of André Green, as am I. You write, quote, what if relational views, and I'm adding about mutual recognition between mother and baby, from the get-go, with their suppositions about early development are fundamentally wrong. If so, to adopt such views could risk ignoring certain constant dangers that beset political practice. This is, I think, part also of a critique you have of Axel Honneth's use of Winnicott, right? I wanted to ask if you could share with us some of your hesitations about the relational psychoanalytic project, because they do seem, the concept of democracy in the clinic is I would argue potentially at the heart co-creation of the relational work, and yet you seem to have a different take, and that in this fascinated me, so I wanted to ask if you could talk to us a little bit about it, if I've understood it correctly.
That's a rich question. So I was raised philosophically with the view that we're, you know, all human beings are social creatures. And I believe that entirely. We are social creatures, that we cannot know the world by ourselves, but with other people. That's all true, right? So in democracy is a co-creation, but we're born into the world necessarily deluded. We're born into the world helpless, completely dependent on others for our life. And if that origin is good enough, we are given this wonderful delusion that we're omnipotent and everything is fine, right? So we're born into what Freud's problematic term, primary narcissism, I prefer to call it plenum, into a kind of sense of well-being that all is met. My bottoms are dry. Milk suit, you know, fills, all is met. And that is, then we're gradually disillusioned that and come to realize that there's a part of the world that's not me, right? I find this very, very compelling. And all of the thinkers that I have been persuaded by, over the years, I realized, and they all agree with me on this, I agree with them, that we're born with this delusion of being all powerful and that all needs are met. So in that delusion, it's not like there's self and other, it's all me, all one. There's no self-other distinction at all. So the baby watchers, you know, I think important research and all of that, but say, look, they can track the baby's eye movements and they immediately track their primary caregivers more as evidence that there is that babies are relational from the start, from the moment. And I just think that's false. And Andre Green's famous essay, I forget, something like something about science fiction, you know that piece? Basically that trying to discern the mental life of an infant by watching its eyes move is like trying to discern the contents of a book by watching someone reading it. We have no idea about the inner world of the child. So, I mean, this is all...
He had a dry sense of humor, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah. We don't know what's going on in the baby. But the reason this matters for me is that if something goes wrong early on in that state, that necessary state of being deluded, and we can talk about that, if something goes wrong, then the path to sociality is really fraught. And it can go wrong. So to say that we're social from the start kind of misses the point, but what if we do not become social in a productive way? What if the mother, and this Andre Green again with the dead mother, what if the mother is depressed or dies in a car wreck, or the father, and so the primary caregiver is just not able to create in me that illusion, then I don't have this ballast, this capacity that carries me through life. That early moment of delusion gives me a capacity to survive in the world. And without that, so I'm in a bad place. I could become a false self. I might not know how to really function well in the world or how to have meaningful relationships. That's a developmental stage to become that social being that we all are. So there's a lot in there, but that's the root of my disagreement with the relational people, is that it's just too pat an answer to say we're social from the start. Well, what if we're not? We need to really attend to how that happens and what can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. To be able to the capacity to deliberate is, you know, developmental, you know, it's a developmental achievement, and we're not born with the capacity to deliberate. I mean, I was, you know, and to listen to each other, because there's no one else but ourselves. I like primary narcissism as a concept, because I think it does just kind of gives us a grounding for what that experience is. Your book takes us into a place. Have a chapter on what the heck is it? On, I'm just going to look here, and I call it Mothers and Nations, but that's not what the chapter is called. That was like my shorthand: Nationalism and the Fear of Breakdown, aka Motherhood, and which was just a beautiful was that ever a standalone piece? Really? That's really good. You could pull it. I mean, you can pull chapters what's out of this book just singularly, although some really, it really works well together. In my opinion, like the sort of the eight chapters that are, you know, laying out, like, what does this kind of different vision of democracy with an awareness of fear of breakdown look like? But the chapter on, I'm just going to call Mothers and Nations, it's not the name of it. It's a standalone. And if you get this book and you don't get to read through the whole book, I just thought it was just a beautiful, wonderful argument. I don't really have a question about it. I just wanted to let you know.
It's interesting because I was, in writing this book, the material that's in the heart of the book on the six democratic practices, it's wedged between the introductory chapters that take us to thinking about politics and the fear of breakdown using Winnicott. And then at the end of those six democratic practices comes back to what's laid out in that chapter on fear of breakdown and takes it into the realm of nationalism. And this is something I'm continuing to work on and thinking about. We want to call it populism, demagoguery, a phenomenon that's really taking over the world. So how do we think about that? What's the root of that? But that was a lot of fun. And then I really went out on a limb, I think, because I'd been reading with Mari Ruti Lacan's seminar on anxiety, where he's really making fun. You know, the root of anxiety is the masculine or male fear of their flagging penis that can't get it up next to women's voracious desire.
Right.
So what if, in one thing that you, I was reading some other books, what that you see in kind of the hyper-nationalism is this anxiety over, hyper-nationalists tend to treat their enemies as pathetic and sick and awful, but their enemies have one power, superpower, and that's their the male's virile sexuality. Mm-hmm. So this notion that the others are trying to get our women is perhaps an actual anxiety that our women are not satisfied and they're going to go over there. Anyway, it's just a few paragraphs, but that was a lot of fun.
It's very powerful, those paragraphs. I got that. I was like, oh, she's going to go there. Woo!
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that would be fun to continue to think through. And it really is a different thinking about way of thinking about women. As I put it here, I quote Winnicott, "The woman figure of primitive unconscious fantasy has no limits to her existence or power." You know, I take him to mean that the group's internal fear of woman is so powerful that it is willing to trade away freedom and democracy for a dictator who will keep women's power in check.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can, those couple of paragraphs where you're talking about, you know, the enemy is virile, is extraordinarily virile. It's almost as if they're highlighted in like bright, even though they're not, like they read that. I just want you to know, I was like, whoa, okay. It was like neon. There was something neon in it all. Wow. So I could tell. I had the feeling that there was a lot of feeling behind
it. Yes. Yeah. I'm starting a new project I'm doing for a little press on feminisms, the Quick Immersion series. And mm-hmm. It's fun because it's not, I'm not supposed to have any footnotes, just talk, you know, speculate and withdraw on others. So I'm looking at how did women become the second sex?
Right. Really?
And it's, I mean, we can look at the history and there is a historical record, the Neolithic mm-hmm. and agriculture and blah, blah, blah. But there's also the powerful imaginary that comes with that about how the world hangs together and who has power and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. And the primitive or primordial anxieties underneath these metaphysical constructs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Jacqueline Rose interview. I would totally refer you to that because her book, Mothers, an Essay on Love and Cruelty, she comes at this question from so many different ways. I think that even if you don't have to like use footnotes, so that's great, but you might just like, I think you two would be in a very good conversation with each other. Absolutely. I mean, when I read your chapter, I was like, oh, it reminded me of Jacqueline's book. So, I think that you would, you know, you wouldn't have to deliberate. You could just have a mirror held up and enjoy it.
Okay. Good.
which we all need. We're actually over, we're over 50 minutes. So, that means that we should be drawing.
Doctor,
things
our time is up.
We'll have to stop there for today. Yes. And we'll leave it on that note.
Okay.
Till tomorrow. So okay. Anyway, this was terrific. Thank you so much for joining us and I think giving us a lot. And then we could be recording on the phone for another hour because there are so many ideas in the book. We didn't get to your critique of Judith Butler's Melancholic Subject. We didn't get to your critique of Habermas. Listeners, it's there. Okay. All of that is there. And it's really what you have to say about Butler is so good. I've always been confused why her essay never sat as well with me as I wanted it to. And you helped me to get closer to it, but we have to stop.
Well, thank you so much. This has been delightful.
Okay. So, dear all, I'm signing off for now. I believe that the next book, up is going to be, M. Fakhri David's Internal Racism. And I'm not sure when I'm doing that interview, but probably, you know, here with the pandemic, probably within the next 6 weeks, I hope to be speaking with Dr. Fokker Davids and again, Dr. Noelle McAfee. Thank you for joining us. All for now.